man, you could just listen to that all morning. Chuck Mangione passed away yesterday at the age, died this week, I believe, earlier this week, as at the age of 84. Flugelhorn player, trumpeter, composer, and we'll be remembering him this morning with the music that goes into our breaks for the panel. And we remember him this morning. If you want to see the playlist and see exactly what we're playing and when, you can certainly do that by going to wamc.org/roundtable, and it'll be good stuff. Beautiful, beautiful music to listen to this morning. Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome. 13 minutes past 9 o'clock on this 25th day of July. A sultry day outside, but man, are we going to heat things up in here.
Good try.
Yeah, we're gonna give it a good old-fashioned try. I'm thrilled about today's panel. We worked very hard to put this panel together for a long time, and we're thrilled that everybody is here, and I will introduce them to you in mere moments. And as always, welcome you to join us, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. .org. All right, let us go to the work at hand. Public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois is with us. Good morning, Teresa. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning. I'm doing well. I'm a huge fan of Chuck Mangione and just love the music. If you're not familiar with it, listen to it. It's great. But also, it's National Hire a Veteran Day. And
all right.
I think we should think about doing that if you have the capacity to
hire a
veteran.
That's what we did with Chris. That's what we got Chris today.
That's why he's here today.
Yeah, he's all over.
That's why he's here today. You're there.
We're not paying him anything. Right.
We
hired him. Yeah.
So important. It's also Hot Fudge Sunday Day.
Oh, that's good too.
And Merry-Go-Round Day.
Oh, merry-go-rounds.
You love them too, don't you?
I do. I grew up, we had a great, my father, who, I was the youngest of five children. Where were you?
I was the oldest of five.
Okay.
As is my husband.
Yeah, so we have issues. But the, my dad's favorite thing growing up in New York, the first thing he did when he got out of high school was went into World War II. So all of his time was spent in his boyhood of going down and going on to these merry-go-rounds and carousels, but the ones with the rings on them. And for those of you who are not familiar with this phenomenon, it was very, very popular. It became less popular as it started to just tear the arms of young children off. But the idea is there's an inanimate object on the outside of the merry-go-round that sort of looks like if you're going to do a shadow puppet of a dog, you would take your pinky and your two fingers on the bottom, two fingers on the top, and open, and then in there would be a ring, and they would feed this with rings. This is where Grab the Brass Ring came from, mm-hmm. because if you got the brass ring, you got a free ride. So you'd have to position yourself on the horse so you could go off one leg, grab the
it's all good.
It's
I think I just took the studio out.
Shot at it. It's all good.
And show you how good I was. So you'd grab the ring, and then at the end you'd see how many rings you have, and hopefully get the brass ring and get a free ride. And so there was a park that still is there, and it still operates this way. It's in Elysburg, Pennsylvania, at Knoebels Grove, and it's an amusement park. And they have one of the last carousels, the grand old carousels with the rings.
And obviously no attorneys on staff.
You know what? I don't know how they get away with it. There's one there. There's also one in Balboa Park in San Diego. And then there's a couple of others in the country. There aren't many left because, you know, of the maiming of children.
Yeah.
So, you know what? I survived. And so I grew up, this is absolutely true, but my father would bring me, we would drive up. It was about 2.5 hours away from Philly. Okay. We'd drive up in the morning. The park opened at noon, but the carousel opened at 9.
Ooh.
We would get on the carousel. We would get off at like 3.
Oh, my. Wow. You were serious.
Yeah. And this is the 70s. So my father would be there wearing his Philadelphia Phillies cap and having this huge cigar in his mouth. And we would just go around and around and around. It was one of my happiest childhood memories.
Oh, I'm so happy. Wow. So this is your day.
Yeah, this is my day.
Brass rings. You learn something new every day. I thought that was Gollum from Lord of the Rings.
You know what? Or that, Chris. Or that. I don't know. It could very well be that.
But wait a minute. Not to prolong this, but you wrote it like all afternoon.
Well, you would go
occasionally get off and throw up and then get back on.
No, it wasn't that turbulent. Fast. Number one. Number two is it had the beautiful old Wurlitzer organ.
Yes.
That would play the music, and it was an original. Everything on that thing was an original, and so it was just a lovely, lovely day.
It's a serious commitment.
But we would get off and get on and do that kind of stuff.
Walk around.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, no, it wasn't like a contest or anything. Okay. It was just that's what we would do all day. And it was really fun.
We had a
very, very good time.
Did you ever go to the one at Glen Echo Park?
No, where is that?
Outside of Washington?
No.
Beautiful.
Rings?
Yeah. Oh, I don't know about the rings. The whole ring thing, I'm not tuned into the ring thing. But, no. Yeah. And, of course, the beautiful merry-go-round in the New York State Museum.
Well, that's absolutely gorgeous, as is the one at the
indoor.
And then outdoor at the Farmers Museum in Cooperstown, done by hand-carved and just an amazing piece of work. If you've never seen it, yeah, I know. You know what? We're just trying to push off the inevitable of talking about the news of the day.
That's right. I just want to get to the next checker and Joni. So well, things are happy.
Former EPA regional administrator, visiting professor at Bennington College, and president of Beyond Plastics, Judith Enck is here. Good morning. How are you?
I am well. Great to be here.
Good to have you. It seems like it's been a long time for you to be here as well, at least in studio.
Yeah, I've been a little busy. Sorry.
All right. No,
Stop.
I'm not complaining.
It kind of sounded like it, Joe.
I know.
Move on.
I'm saving the world.
Yes, I'm saving the world. That's right.
No,
Judith, thank you very much. We're going to get that mic just a little bit closer to you so everyone can hear everything you have to say. By the way, I just was I momentarily blocked on the name, but Jerry Holzer was the guy who was the carver, the master carver that did the New York State Carousel at the Farmers Museum. And if you ever get a chance to go out and see that and to do that experience, it is stunning, absolutely beautiful. It's an incredible work. We lost Jerry about a year and a half ago. He was a dear, dear friend of mine, lived in my town, and we miss him horribly. But it was very, very nice if you ever get a chance to do that. All right. We are also thrilled to have Mark Whitman with us, investment banker on Wall Street. Good morning, Mark. How are you?
I'm good, Joe. Good morning.
Good morning. And, you know, people ask me all the time, oh, you're Mr. Interviewer. Who do you want? Who you tried hardest to get on the show? Well, this is absolutely true. I've been trying to get Chris Gibson on this show since he retired from Congress. And we have always wanted him on. And I think because he has a really good agent, he has avoided us for years. But you know what happens? And you're going to know this too, Judith. Once you read a book, you want everything, you know, and it's a little bit easier. So Chris, who has been wonderful to the station, he and his wife, Mary Jo, have been terrific supporters. And have worked so hard with the station and helping us over the years, and have just been wonderful, wonderful people and friends of this radio station, personal friends. And it is a great honor to welcome Chris Gibson to the program. Writer, analyst, recently retired from the presidency of Siena College. He was a former New York congressman, and he has a brand new book out, which is should be essential reading for all, called The Spirit of Philadelphia. Chris, a great pleasure. Thank you very much for being here.
Hey, Joe, excited to be with you and all the panelists today. And I do want to echo Teresa's comments. You know, you mentioned the book. Part of the research, I spent a fair amount of time in philosophy. Plato spoke to this, influenced by Pythagoras, but he said that the soul knows truth, and in no place is it more true than with music. And that sublimity that we feel when we listen to Chuck Mangione, I mean, Plato would say that that was a connection with truth. And I agree. So thank you, Teresa. Great. And we'll have a chance to listen to that music as the morning proceeds.
What did Plato say about merry-go-rounds?
No, he didn't anticipate that. It maybe should have, right?
But there's music on merry-go-round, so.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Very good. Yeah.
I just want to add, Chris is my former member of Congress. I would write him letters and call him.
As he is mine.
And he was incredibly helpful on the PFOA drinking water crisis in Hoosick Falls.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Boy, appreciate that.
We think of the souls in heaven right now because of the cancer. Mm-hmm. And thank you for your work on that. Really important.
We are lucky to have this group assembled, so let's put them to work and talk about the what is going on today. There are many things, and we will start again. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. All right. We mentioned yesterday we were talking about Columbia and the Columbia University and the settlement that took place with the Trump administration. And now that we've had a day for this all to settle, if you will, what happened there? Let's take a look at it. Did Columbia's deal save its stature or sacrifice it? Is one of the questions that the New York Times asks in an article that is published in this morning's edition, and it is also available online. Talks in Washington, an expert on negotiation. The university chose cooperation with President Trump over litigation, a strategy both praised and pilloried. You're a former college president, Chris Gibson. What do you make of this?
Yeah, I'm concerned just about the arc of all the interactions here. Look, I'll start by saying anti-Semitism is a major concern, and it's real. I like the Teddy Roosevelt approach to this more so than the expansive or coercive arm of government. I think it's more prone to corruption in the way that we've just done this and intimidation. Roosevelt, look, when he Andrew Carnegie had donated significantly to his campaign. But there were issues with combinations and trusts, and Roosevelt thought that this went to the heart of, really a fair deal in America. He chose to use an existing law that hadn't been enforced, the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890, and he took Carnegie to court, and he won in the Northern Securities decision. I think if our federal government, regardless who's in the White House, Republican, Democrat, Trump-like, or Obama-like, does not matter. I think what's better and more consistent with founding principles, which is really something that I spent the last 2.5 years in a deep dive with, we'd be better off to take them to court. And the reason why it's more precise as it relates to the potential or the alleged anti-Semitism. Because you can hold individuals and institutions accountable and rather than this interaction, because ultimately what's happened here? Well, I watched the interview last night with the Columbia president. She says, look, I didn't admit to anything. She's not making any kind of concession about anti-Semitism, but yet they're paying all this money. So I think it sets a concerning precedent for colleges that maybe and universities that are looking at what are our choices here. Maybe we should just settle. And I think that this makes the entire endeavor vulnerable to coercion and therefore corruption. And we want less of that, not more.
Judah, think.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think this is a stain on Columbia, a fine academic institution. There should be no room for anti-Semitism, no room for Islamophobia. I think most professors and students agree to that. Columbia should have fought this. You cannot acquiesce to Donald Trump because he will come back for more. And here you're going to have the federal government having input on curriculum, on what free speech of students is protected and what isn't. I think one of the most important things a college student experiences is paying attention to the world around them and becoming politically active. I don't care, you know, as long as it's nonviolent and it's not discriminatory, I don't care what issue students get engaged on. The most important thing is for them to have civic association. I'm privileged to teach at Bennington in the Center for the Advancement of Public Action. We encourage public action, as every campus should. So I think Columbia made a huge mistake. They should not have settled this. I think they would have won in court. And if a giant institution like Columbia cannot stand up to the Trump administration, you know, what does that say? Now, you would argue that Harvard is standing up. They've got a bigger endowment. Columbia has a, I'm sympathetic. They have a lot of research money at stake. But this is a really bad moment for Columbia. And I think it's also going to affect whether students want to go there in the future and whether professors want to teach there.
Teresa.
Yeah, I agree with everything you both said. And I've like to look at it from a larger perspective, in that the hypocrisy of Trump and his administration going after these universities for making people feel unsafe or anti-Semitism. I mean, I just can never forget Trump in Charlottesville and the tiki torches and the chants of the Jews will not replace us, and him saying, well, there are good people on both sides, right? And also, the notion of making people feel unsafe. Well, what about the bullying of the poll watchers, right, to the point where they feared for their life and couldn't stay in their homes? What about the bullying of the Trump and his administration does of judges and members of Congress, so much so that a Republican U.S. senator talks about fearing for her life, and former Senator Mitt Romney talks about, well, I can speak out against him because I have the resources to protect myself and my family to pay for the security. I mean, so yes, anti-Semitism is wrong. Yes, making people feel unsafe is wrong. But there's a lot of hypocrisy in this. And, you know, I don't think anti-Semitism is, I think for them, anti-Semitism is a tool, not the purpose, right? And you have to look at this in the context of the overall attack of this administration on our university system and how dangerous that is. Attack, you know, undermining their research. We are the envy of the world in university-based research. It's what drives our economy. He wants to reinvigorate manufacturing, claims to. You don't do that by decimating university-based research, whether it's going after them for this. And it's really a controlling mechanism, just like he's using litigation to try to control other, you know, we'll talk about Skydance later and other things. I just think overall, this is a very serious problem, and we have to call out the silence of the Republicans in the House and Senate because they are complicit in their silence. This is very dangerous, what's happening to our universities.
You know, I just want to say that for the moment, look at the vantage point of the Trump supporters. You know, many of them want some accountability with regard to the actions on the campus. My point is with this, you haven't gotten it. I mean, it just hasn't happened. So if the intent was to hold an institution, they made allegations. So this has not been adjudicated. And again, the president last night of Columbia University denies anything. So if that's what the ultimate goal was here, was to enforce, you know, civil rights and to have accountability, this settlement has not done it. And that's my point.
And I worry, too, about silencing dissent. I mean, look at what's going on in Gaza right now. It is unthinkable what's going on in Gaza. And before, you had, when Biden administration, you had the media every day asking him, the press secretary, everybody about what was going on in Gaza. You had students. I'm sorry, we're over time.
No, go ahead.
And you had students protesting around the country. You don't hear any of that. Is that because they've become so fearful of it, right? Where is the outcry about the horrific starvation that's happening in Gaza?
In the New York Times article about this morning, I thought it was interesting because they're talking about the meetings that took place between the Columbia president and Linda McMahon of the Education Department. And they basically, one of the things that they agreed to, at least, that Shipman allowed was that they did indeed feel that they had an anti-Semitism problem on campus. What I found interesting is, okay, but does a $200 million fine, A, cure that, and B, what does that do, and what are you being fined for as a result of what happened, and why can't that matter just be addressed and corrected as opposed to putting this money into the coffers?
Can I ask a question?
You can ask a question, then I want to get to Mark, but go ahead.
So the what I wonder about is the mechanism of this oversight. They say the government's going to have people come in and monitor universities. But we hear on the way in this morning NPR story about now they've successfully eliminated more than half of the staff of the Department of Education. Who is going to come in and monitor universities? And what's the mechanism? How does that happen? As a president of a university, how's the federal government going to come in and monitor a university?
Well, you know, I don't know the answer to that. But in relation to that and what Joe just mentioned, I mean, now you're getting to the heart of my concerns because, you know, I hear your points that you made as far as those, you know, the arguments for the Palestinian people. That and also I listened and watched the students at Columbia who were Jewish American or Jewish and from other nations, and they felt unsafe. And I don't think there's anything. I know there was some, you know, sort of like hand wave towards this issue. But there's, to your point, Joe, there's no clarity on what's changing in terms of colleges and universities, in terms of their actual behavior. I think they would have been better off bringing, if the federal government, like Teddy Roosevelt, they should have brought a lawsuit and they should have had specific allegations. They should have adjudicated those and there should have been resolution to exactly how this won't happen again in the future. I don't feel like we've done that.
Mark Whitman.
Well, Joe, I'm going to join the chorus and say that this is profoundly disappointing. I think Columbia's board missed two important facts. And frankly, I'd point them to their own darn mission statement, at least the end of it, which says it expects all areas of the university to advance knowledge and learning at the highest level and to convey the products of its efforts to the world. So how did Columbia fail on its own mission? Well, first of all, if you're talking about advancing knowledge and learning, the one thing that Columbia did, at least as the education department sees it, in the person of Linda McMahon, boy, that still just doesn't sound right, does it? Mm. Is that they missed the fact
Hulk
that—
Hulk Hogan, RIP. Go ahead.
Yeah, they missed the fact that this is now going to become a template. So they literally belied their own mission statement in terms of in terms of promulgating knowledge by caving in. The other thing that they missed was that the Trump administration has 3.5 years left to it. And as I often advise nonprofits, most of them should be thinking of themselves in terms of forever. So Trump may well come back to this well again, but even more importantly, the Trump administration sets a precedent for the next 3.5 years. Columbia set a damning precedent that it and other institutions now have to deal with for forever. Trump will be a blip in the history of Columbia. Sadly enough, too, the fact that Columbia caved will be a larger and sadder blip for education broadly in this country. Now, I understand they're thinking, I've got researchers, I've got research that's going to be impaired if I don't cave. But when you're thinking about your obligations to forever, you look at the short term, rightfully, very differently. And Columbia missed it, and it missed its own mission statement when it caved the way it did. And this has nothing to do with anti-Semitism. If you want to look at an intelligent discussion of the failures of institutions with respect to that and anti-Islamophobia, look at Harvard's very clear-eyed self-examination and some of what it's suggesting you're doing. There's no way that Linda McMahon, who if you read the letter that she wrote to, I believe she wrote it to Harvard, that letter was more a script from one of her pageant pugilists in the Wrestling Federation than it was a serious discussion of the issues that they need to deal with. There's no chance that the government, Harvard or Columbia, is going to benefit in its mission in terms of treating students more righteously by government oversight. The other thing I would say is it churns my stomach when I read outlets, even like the Washington Post, say that Columbia has agreed to an independent monitor. what the hell does independent mean in the case of the Trump administration? So I think the caving and the fix itself actually make getting at the putative problem here more difficult than it would have been had a very different approach been taken. And I think Columbia bears a lot of responsibilities. And I think its stakeholders, if I had anything to do with Columbia, I would work like hell to overturn all that board.
Mm-hmm. You made the point, and several of you made this point, about how we know that probably the Trump administration will go back to this well again at some point. The precedent is unbelievable, and I mentioned this yesterday on the show, but it's like it's the Lisa Murkowski effect. It's just like, we want you to vote for the bill. I don't want to vote for the bill. Oh, well, we'll give you this and this and this and this. Oh, okay, I want to do that for the people of Alaska. I will vote for the bill. Can I have that stuff now? No.
Right.
And you have a very vibrant student body at Columbia. Classes start in about a month. What happens the first week of class when Jewish students organize a public event about releasing hostages from Hamas, and students that are really concerned about the forced starvation in Gaza hold a public event calling for change? So who's going to patrol that? Is one demonstration allowed and the other isn't? What happens to the students who participate, particularly what happens to international students who are going to be worried about our visa? This is, I mean, I understand a huge corporation that needs to answer to shareholders just on fiduciary responsibilities, but for a college, a well-respected institution of higher learning, to fold like this is really unconscionable.
And don't you think if these universities had joined forces, and they have very powerful alumni bases, right? I'm sure Columbia has alumni in very important positions, and I just think that they should have known their power a little bit more and used it. And yes, the numbers are daunting, but the government needs their research, right? And I don't know. I just think this is echoing what you've all said, an incredibly bad precedent. And I think that the argument on behalf of the administration is phony. I am deeply concerned that Jewish students would not feel safe. I don't think that they're that serious about that concern. They're using that as a tool to try to gain power.
The other thing that we talked about yesterday, and I would just like, before we go to a break, go to get Chris's perspective on this, again, as a college president, but $200 million, that's going to have an effect on the average student who goes to that university.
You know, it will. It's more the precedent, though. Right. You know, Columbia just appears lost. And, you know, they think that this is going to make the issue go away. It won't. If history is any guide, this very same issue will come back again. But and that's concerning, as Judith just pointed out. But it's even the broader context and issues that are going to be related to this settlement. The ambiguity is going to be so overwhelming that even Columbia could come back again and make another offer. So they're going to be negotiating against themselves. And then the other colleges and universities who may not be so well established, may not be so well funded in terms of endowments. And, you know, you're going to hear the word precedent come up saying, look, you're up against the weight of justice, because that's the claim. They're going to claim that this was justice. I mean, it's highly debatable. In fact, I would say it's not. Yeah. But they're going to claim that. I mean, that's the whole point of a settlement. Yeah, sides may say, well, we're not agreeing. Yeah, but essentially, this was the resolution, if you will. And that's going to be problematic, I think, for all of higher ed. Higher ed folks have mentioned it here, but really it's about a broad liberal arts education, looking at the best and worst that humanity has gone through, and how can we learn from that so we can go forward. And now – and I regret the fact that you see this heavy-handed federal involvement in this, whether it be from – if this would have been in the Obama administration, in this case it's the Trump administration – you know, my research for the Spirit of Philadelphia, I'm principally opposed to this level of intrusion at the federal level.
Which is ironic, isn't it? Because what they're saying is that we're going to send education back to the states. We're going to send education back to the states. And then they interfere at this level. And it's $200 million for this settlement. But what about all of the other things the Trump administration is doing to higher education that's going to have an impact on Columbia? How much is there, I don't know any other word than squeeze on allowing foreign students to come in, right? So what's the economic impact on that on Columbia to make students from other countries fear and go elsewhere?
And just to contrast this with the Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt example I gave is that Roosevelt had some precise actions he was looking to impact, and he broke up those combinations in trust. So when you take a look at this, he actually addressed the phenomenon, whereas now we have this settlement. And, you know, the administration was savvy in this way because the $200 million had more to do with the precedent in terms of – and they can now extrapolate and really provide a narrative of as to what this is and then use it to coerce going further. I think to address the anti-Semitism, they should have really adjudicated this in a process. And if there were found to be problems, they should have been absolutely addressed as part of the settlement. And maybe some people need to lose their job in the process. But that's the accountability, not this.
And remember, this is a pattern. Was it a month ago? You know, these horrors build up and we forget University of Virginia president was forced out. Right. One of the most accomplished professors they had there, who was acknowledging the history of racial discrimination that the college itself was involved in. So there are certainly some real double standards. And then the other presidents who testified in Congress, admittedly not particularly well, a couple of them lost their jobs. So this is, I mean, I think this is the pattern in this undemocratic presidency of going after civic institutions.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have a lot of letters from our listeners. We'll get to those, and then we'll move on to other topics as well. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Teresa Bourgeois, Judith Enck, Chris Gibson, and Mark Whitman with us this morning. We are very happy to have all of those individuals around these microphones. We welcome you as well, panel at WAMC.org. Let me get to as many letters as we possibly can. John says, Trump and his legion of evil don't care at all. Shouty caps. About Jewish students, they care about controlling higher education, turning U.S. universities into party ideology factories. Didn't WAMC's founder warn that the fascists always try to take over the universities? Yes, Alan did. Lastly, the only way to stand up to a bully is for all of the bully's victims and the bystanders to team up and kick the bully's ass, because that's the only language a bully understands. All right, we move on. Phyllis, Columbia is worried about research funds. Will this oversight control what they can and cannot research?
Right. I think that's a finish the letter. Then
Just what a horrible can of worms that is.
Yeah, says I think Phyllis. That's a crucial part of this that hasn't been acknowledged. Columbia does some really important research on climate science. I think this independent monitor will shut that down. The Lamont Doherty Lab, I mean, it is, it's really important, and I think they're fooling themselves if they think they can just go along the way they used to.
Cindy writes, how is this not extortion? Please, please tell me. Then we go to Arabella. Being opposed to Israel's policies on the Palestinians is not anti-Semitism. Susan says, I understand and appreciate the careful parsing of the university issue. It is about bullying and headlines. Bottom line, the rest is just fiddling. Caving to this is inexcusable. And then we go to John, who says, how come President Trump can sue personally while president, but no one can sue him?
Because he has immunity from the Supreme Court for his presidential activities, not personal.
And finally, for this break, Donald says, in Trump's logic, allowing students or faculty to express sympathy for Palestinians or oppose Israel's actions in Gaza equates to anti-Semitism. By his logic, Bernie Sanders, a Jew, is anti-Semitic. That from Don. All right, let's move on to other topics because we have a lot brewing this morning, and I want to get to as many things as we possibly can in the time that we have allowed. Let's talk about the Skydance merger, certainly a lot about that that we have discussed over the last several weeks and months, and this has brought on many changes, and from 60 Minutes to Stephen Colbert and maybe South Park, and not to mention the settlement that was reached. Now the FCC said Thursday that it would allow Paramount to merge with the Hollywood studio Skydance, clearing the way for one of the most highly scrutinized media deals in the last decade. Brendan Carr, the chairman of the FCC, said in a statement that the agency had approved the deal after receiving assurances from Skydance that the new company would be committed to unbiased journalism and would not establish programs related to diversity, equity, and inclusion. Americans no longer trust the legacy national news media to report fully, accurately, and fairly, Mr. Carr said in the statement. It's time for a change. That's why I welcome Skydance's commitment to make significant changes at the once-storied CBS broadcast network.
This was a partisan vote at the FCC, and you just look at recent history. July 1st, Paramount agrees to pay $16 million to settle Trump's personal lawsuit against CBS. Then a few weeks later, on the 22nd of July, Trump and Paramount dismiss the case, formalizing the settlement. July 24th, the Trump-appointed FCC approves this merger. And remember, just a week ago, Stephen Colbert's show is canceled, theoretically for economic reasons. So I think it's pretty transparent what's going on here. And I also saw a social media post by President Trump saying that he's going after Seth Meyers and Jimmy Kimmel, St. Rose alum, next. I mean, I think it's kind of like, on one hand, it's comedy shows. On the other hand, it's unbelievably chilling. And I think we're going to see more of this. And, you know, it's these giant media companies settling is really crazy, similar to Columbia, you know, similar to other things. The other point I want to make is if these captains of industry are doing this just for economic reasons, the person that I think had the most interesting analysis of this is Jon Stewart.
Yes.
He's only on Monday nights. You can tape it if you can't stay up till 11.
Stream it later. Watch it later.
And he made the point that CBS and Paramount are making all of these changes because they were worried that this multi-billion dollar deal was going to fall through. Well, people watch CBS I mostly have watched it for 60 Minutes and Colbert. People are not going to watch that anymore. And over time, they're going to lose a lot of money in order to preserve what they think was their economic decision. It makes no sense.
Yeah. So, look, I get this issue goes red hot. We can chase that rabbit all the way down the hole. I'm going to back up for a second and just say, you know, I'm concerned. I understand that some of the Trump supporters, like, they like the fact that what President Trump is doing and how he's doing it because, you know, we're going to make people change and, you know, maybe even get payback for some other things. But what I'm saying is from a larger arc of history – and from a review of how power is arrayed, I don't think those supporters are going to be happy if this principle or precedent, which is then at least in its ideal supported by a principle, they're not going to be happy about a federal government that is not only essentially overturning state policy now, which is not something the founders wanted to see happen. They really saw co-sovereignty as the approach. And founding principles conservatives have always tried to protect states' prerogatives. Not only are we seeing that, but we're seeing actually reaching all the way into private companies.
this is not a good precedent, and founding principles conservatives are going to be concerned. With regard to some of the specifics, there is already a precedent out there for equal time. And so if you want to bring a case, mm-hmm. you can bring a case for equal time. You know, with regard to the media, it's important. My research also points to this, that we've actually gone in cycles with regard to the media. Actually, at the very beginning, media was very partisan. I mean, this is the – you had like Federalist, you had Democrat, Republican printing houses. And, you know, essentially this is actually part of Jefferson's legacy. It's not it, – there's allegations here. But, I mean, the big surprise in the lead up to the 1800 is there were some newspapers that flipped and actually surprisingly didn't go for the Federalist candidate. Went, one of them was this guy named Callender, and he came out for Jefferson. This was decisive. That was an upset, that election in 1800. But you know what? Callender came out with the early stories on Sally Hemings. And – Callender, the guy, the editor, ended up, you know, belly up in the Potomac. He was killed. So, you know, so we went through a period where we had partisan. And by the way, I'm not necessarily making a slam dunk case that, but I am giving you facts that happened. So we had these partisan news outlets, and then we had the blowing up of the Maine in 1898, and there was a focusing event, and people really said, let's try to move towards a more objective media. Randolph Hearst played a role here. And essentially, for about the next 75, 80 years, we had because we had broadcasts, 6, 10, and 13, and you could actually get your arms around this, you had the Walter Cronkite, you know, sort of model. And then the Vietnam War. But then it also correlated with the information age, with the fracturing because of cable news. Here's where we are today. If you're of right wing or left wing, you can go to a news source and just drink from your own bathwater. You can just get news from your own place. If it has to do with broadcast and you feel like you're being mistreated in terms of time, you can claim this. You can bring a case for equal time. So, you know, as I look at this merger, I'm concerned because I see yet another example of the federal government. I understand, again, I understand the Trump supporters are pleased at the moment, but they're not going to be pleased with the precedent and the principle that is being instantiated here.
One of the things, Judith touched on this, but John Stewart, when he did, not this last round, but when he was on with Steve Croft talking about the settlement, mm-hmm. and one of the things that he did is he showed the two versions of the interview with Kamala Harris that had been done and the editing that the president objected to as a result, leading to the settlement. Then he showed what Fox News did in the exact same case. Mm-hmm. And it was almost identical. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter. I mean, that's just what the media does. It's not for nefarious purposes. It's to edit for time and to get
every
in as
interview.
Much.
Every interview. You try to edit us and we keep talking.
You know what? This show would be 8 minutes long if we edited it. So, but here's the thing, and that always is what you disagree, Mark. but we would try to, you try to get that those facts out, and the other thing, I just want to say this, and then we'll get to everybody else. But every journalist, journalism school looked at that and said there is nothing wrong right. with what they did.
They would have won the case.
They would have won the case. It was a nothing case. It was an absolutely nothing case that became something. And now we have this merger with money on the line, which we're not even sure when it comes to the settlement of how much money is on the line, because originally it was one price and now apparently there's going to be dollar added as far as announcements and causes that can be celebrated as a result of the settlement on behalf of the president. Mark.
I look at this from an economic lens. I think what Paramount and Skydance and Paramount and the person to share Redstone are doing here is preserving value that's been significantly diluted by the fracturing of the media landscape. I think last time CBS itself sold, it was a $30 billion transaction. this all of Paramount, I'm sure there are pieces that have slipped in and out, but all of Paramount is worth $8 billion in this transaction. So Sherry Redstone wants to sort of staunch the bleeding, which has happened because of the fracturing of the media environment, as well as the mismanagement, arguably, of Paramount itself. I think what she and the board are doing is entirely defensible. They're responding to a government that's putting strictures on them, and they're deciding the best way to preserve shareholder value in light of that. There's a little bit of a fiction that we're uncovering here, which is that these news departments would exist inside of for-profit corporations. And so long as they're not misrepresenting facts, they can run that sort of any way they want. It's irresponsible to say we're being unbiased when they're being biased. But if they want to run a terribly biased news outlet, that's their right. The one thing is the news outlets are becoming toxic. And because of this administration, if you look at Netflix, it's entered almost every other portion of broadcasting as it's expanded its abilities. But it ain't touching news. And probably for this reason largely, which is it's economically very difficult to find a model that works, particularly if you have to deal with this administration. The problem here is primarily political. The Trump administration is doing something that we as the populace shouldn't be allowing it to do. And that's a feedback loop that seems broken. And I do think there's a legalistic way of impinging upon what the administration's trying to do. The one thing that I have trouble finding is which group of claimants is going to claim their harm, because Paramount has the right to allay this and say, look, we're out for our bottom line. We're not our first consideration here is not the First Amendment and the attendant protections that we've built around that. Although I think that's what's being degraded. But that's not Paramount's. That's not the board's responsibility. The question is what group? Somebody needs to be creative legally about what group can take action against the government when the board decides, I think rightfully, that it doesn't want to do that. But I think we shouldn't delude ourselves about the fact that this is an economic transaction with an administration that's dramatically overstepping its bounds and probably breaking the laws around free speech.
All right. So here's what's happening in the studio. We've had three members voice their opinion on this particular issue. We're up against the clock. Ray has to do the news. Just as Mark was talking, Teresa's eyes hit the top of her head, and there was a furrow in her brow. So I want to unpack that, but we do have to take a break. So we'll do that, and we'll be right back after this.
That's a good way to go.
Welcome back to the roundtable. This group is on fire. They are
like the planet.
Pumped up, man. This is great. So we're going to harness it into 1 hour of broadcasting, and we will do that beginning now. My thanks to all of you for being here in the great group that we have assembled, Judith Eng, Chris Gibson, Mark Whitman, and Teresa Bourgeois. And we thank you, the listener, panel@wamc.org, if you would like to get in on the discussion as well. We were talking right before the break about the FCC approving Skydance's merger with Paramount. We heard from Judith, Chris, and Mark, and we have not yet heard from the the stylings of one Teresa Bourgeois.
Right. So specifically on the agreement, one of the things I find really disturbing that we're sort of alluding to is this telling the agency that's going to install an official of the company within the news agency, essentially as a monitor. That's not journalism, right? I mean, you can't. That's what would Walter Cronkite say, right? You know, what would he say? And Anne Gomez, who is the Democrat on the Federal Communications, Democratic Commissioner on the Federal Communications Commission, which, by the way, the Trump administration, their vacancies, which they're not filling because it keeps them in control of the outcomes of the FCC, which is very important to some of their interests. But she talks about that there was powers to pressure Paramount to broker a private legal settlement and further erode press freedom. But, quote, even more alarming, it's now imposing never-before-seen controls over newsroom decisions and editorial judgments in direct violation of the First Amendment and the law. And I think that we talk about precedents. This is yet another really dangerous precedent that's been set. But I'd like to encourage people to step back and look at the bigger issue of who the key players are in this. And Larry Ellison, so they talk about David Ellison, who's the president of Skydance. He is the son of Larry Ellison, who's worth about $175 billion. And much of the money in this is Larry Ellison money.
And he's a big Trump donor.
Right. Ellison. And so he is the head of Oracle. Let's just say, as an aside, Oracle has a contract with the Heritage Foundation to create a database of people who would be the right people for the Trump administration to bring in. This is a project that's been worked on for a long time. And his background, he's an AI guy, artificial intelligence. He's a data guy. And you just, ended up as a deep dive into Larry Ellison last night. And as I said at the break, when I was on my third bowl of ice cream, I realized I was seriously stress eating the more I read about him. And the more his stated goal is to create this vast tranche of data in which he believes you can then control what's going on, and that he can make people feel happier if he creates this environment where he controls what they're doing. It's unbelievable.
But you see that as transactional, right, Teresa? It's not ideological.
Right.
Okay. It's
a power base.
Is CBS going to be more like Fox?
Well, what I'm just saying, I personally experienced this. In my last election, Silicon Valley donated almost 100% for my opponent. And you can look it up. These are matters of fact. You can go to the FEC.
Oh, yeah, they're actually trying.
So all these names, I'm not going to mention them by name here, but you could. And you'll see that they all max donated to my opponent.
So who does Trump want to purchase TikTok? Larry Ellison. That's his goal, is to get Larry Ellison. He said it publicly. He wants Larry Ellison to own TikTok. Why does Larry Ellison want to own TikTok? Because it's a tranche of data for his AI systems, right? And so he owns Paramount, right? CBS. He takes control of TikTok, right? That's an enormous amount of data. And this former staff person, all these pieces are coming together to form something that isn't quite clear yet, but the concept for the Ellison family will be at the center. And I think that years ago, when I first went to Washington, I worked at a Nader group that monitored the Federal Communications Commission. And there was tremendous focus then on the dangers of concentration of power in information sources. And I think this is leading us to a whole different level that we don't even begin to understand yet. But I think people need to pay attention, because at the end of one of these articles, one of the outside experts talked about the power is in the data. And that's what really this is. This is amassing access to enormous amounts of data, and we need to be paying attention to that. Is that too conspiratorial?
No, you're never too conspiratorial.
I know, I don't have the capacity.
We've been talking. This is our second story that we've done, and all these stories are, we want to mention them and we want to talk about them. It's 14 minutes past 10 o'clock. I don't think there is a bigger story right now, a more important story, a more heartbreaking story than what is going on in Gaza.
Yes.
And I do want to mention that, because that's the biggest story that is happening in our world right now. For nearly 2 years, people in Gaza have faced death by airstrikes, tanks, and bullets. Now many are facing a slower, quieter end. They are dying from starvation. This from Lauren Jackson in the New York Times. It's a crisis that Gaza's few remaining functional hospitals can treat. There is no one in Gaza now outside the scope of famine, not even myself, said the doctor who leads the pediatric ward at Nasser Hospital in southern Gaza. I am speaking to you as a health official, but I too am searching for flour to feed my family. As Gaza faces a looming famine, its social order is breaking down, looting is rampant, Chaos surrounds the enclave's few aid delivery sites. Israeli troops have opened fire on civilians waiting for food again and again. The United Nations says more than 1,000 people are trying to get food have been killed since May. After 21 months of devastating war in Gaza, it can be difficult to discern when conditions there have meaningfully shifted. But Times correspondents are clear. Gaza is descending into anarchy. It's a crisis that appears unlikely to abate soon, as Israel and the U.S. said yesterday they would withdraw from ceasefire talks with Hamas below. Just looking at this problem, you can see what is happening and can be so concerned and wonder exactly what will help address this horrible fact that is going on in our world. Mark Whitman.
Joe, thanks for bringing this up. This has been bothering me. I want to just state some simple what I think are facts. The United States government has the ability to tell Israel when. It's had it since Eisenhower. Reagan exercised it. Bush exercised it. And Donald Trump just exercised it a couple weeks ago, I think a little bit too early, frankly, in the Iran conflict. But we have the ability to tell Israel when. There is a faction within the Israeli government that doesn't want the conflict in Gaza to end, and a broader faction that is using food as a weapon. Mm-hmm. Now, there actually is an explanation, not a justification, but there's an explanation, which is when you send more food in, Hamas gets some of it and uses it in various ways to increase their power. But I would argue on behalf of the Israelis specifically that they are better off facing the complications that presents than starving the Gazans to death, not only morally, but politically. I also believe that in this country, there are lots of politicians wondering what they should do to best protect children. And this touches on another topic. And we're talking about what is it you should hit up your local congressperson for when you see them at the fair or at their town hall or the rest of it. If you want to protect children in the current day, today, you need to ask your congressperson, you need to ask anyone with any ability to influence this administration, why the heck is it we're not telling the Israelis enough? You cannot starve children into submission as part of this effort. And the devastation that's been wrought, you look at those horrible pictures of the emaciated children, and I've got news. Long before that child is emaciated, you have in most cases forever impaired their development throughout their life before you've gotten to that point. And that rings true, by the way, for children in Sudan as well. So what bothers me about the disproportionate amount of focus on protecting children in this country and conspiracies around that is if we really want to do it, we've got the ability to do it in Gaza, and there's basically one person who needs to say stop, and the Israelis will. It kills me every day that we haven't gotten to that answer, and also kills me that lots of people are looking at the stars thinking, well, how should we play this other issue? There's one, and think about this issue with respect to Gaza. If you want to be hard, cold, and political about it, the good news is if he capitulates, Trump, then you've prevailed and you've at least staunched this carnage. And if you don't, or every day that he doesn't, you get to use that politically if you want to be that cold about it. Why we're not focusing on that more as a country is beyond me.
Chris?
Yeah. So, look, I support Israel's right to defend themselves. What I've said for some time is I don't think they're pursuing their best interests. I agree with what Mark says here. Look, two things. One is my understanding is they're closer to an agreement than what this appears like this morning. In fact, they're talking about numbers of how many Palestinians are going to be released, and is one of the major hangups I'm understanding is, and there's hope that maybe with this moment today, they'll actually come to an accommodation. But as Mark points out, continuing on this arc, which leads to more starvation, it's not in anyone's interest. It is a humanitarian crisis. And by the way, Trump did allude to this in the administration last night. we now have the upper hand as far as and reserve the right for kinetic raids. So, you know, if we think that we have a lead on getting these hostages back, we have highly competent special operation forces. So what's in the interest of everyone, including the United States right now, is to get this ceasefire in place. Hamas has already been not only badly damaged, but they've been discredited. You just listen to the arguments coming from the Palestinian people. I think this is going to end up being resolved if Israel moves like right now on moving towards a ceasefire. I think they're in a good position to achieve their strategic objectives. If they prolong this conflict, this is only going to work against their short, mid, and long-term interests.
Teresa.
First of all, I applaud Mark for your statement. I thought that was really important because, and these are American dollars, either American, you know, that are driving this. And these are American dollars that should be going in, not to the two groups who are, you know, in theory overseeing the distribution of food, but those dollars should be going to the network of legitimate aid agencies who know how to distribute food in a crisis like this. There's a mechanism, and it doesn't include just four sites where people are shot to death regularly. More than 100 people, children have been shot trying to get life-saving food. And the U.S. is funding this. These are our tax dollars. And where are the reporters every day at the White House asking the president every stop he should be asked, what about the people being starved in Gaza? What are you doing? President Biden was asked over and over and over again. Why is the media not asking? Why is the public calling into their congressional offices, like you said, Mark, saying to your Democrat, Republican, House, and Senate members, what are you doing about the starving children in Gaza? This is unprecedented. And I just think, you know, you look back and you say, during the Holocaust, why didn't people do something? And I, you know, I say to myself, what am I doing? What can I do? And not unlike what's happening, I think, in this country with ICE snatching people, right? Those are two things that I think are deep moral issues. Like, what can each of us do to stop this? Because what's happening in Gaza is just indefensible. And it's happening with our dollars.
And the overall starvation, I mean, certainly the children are at the center of this. And those pictures, as you mentioned, Mark, are just beyond anything that a human brain can comprehend. All I wanted to say is that you hear from that doctor who is working with those children and also can't feed their family, journalists who are reporting on the story who are also starving.
Dying of starvation. And their companies are trying to get them out, and they can't get the Israelis to help them get their people out or get food into them.
Well, the Israelis are not opening the gates, right, letting the food to get in. I mean, I deeply appreciate Mark's comments and everyone's comments, but this is the moral issue of our lives, I believe. And the response from Congress is pathetic. I mean, I call Schumer, I call Gillibrand, I get nothing in response on what they are doing. There's the horrible issue of people dying from starvation. I don't even call it famine because, you know, there are horrible famines around the world where climate change has caused drought and lack of rain. This is purposefully starving an entire population. They have to open the gates so all the trucks that are lined up with food can get in. Israel won't do it. The world community response has been, I think, tepid. I think it points to the weakness of the United Nations. I mean, the UN and the food program and the program led by Cindy McCain, they have been ringing the bell on this for a really long time, and no one is listening. And so I think the question for us as a community is, what do we do? You know, Trump's not going to listen to us. Mike Johnson, canceled extra time in Congress so they could run home early for their August recess, so they didn't have to address the pedophile issue.
I do think that President Trump wants to end this. He's tried. He's frustrated. He can't seem to find
it. Wait. The one thing I disagree with is you don't have to end this to feed those people.
Right.
That's the one mistake that the Biden administration, frankly, Teresa, go ahead. You can roll your eyes at me. But they made this mistake to begin with. They let the Israelis put the negotiation of the provision of food to human beings as part of a peace deal. Nonsense. Nonsense. That's not where it belongs. It belongs as a fundamental human obligation to other human beings when you have de facto controlled their territory through blockade.
But they did pressure. The Biden administration did pressure to get food in, and more food was going in. Not enough, but more food. It was slow.
Some food got in, and they let this issue sit in the negotiation table. That was their mistake. It never should have been there. It should always have been, no, you're not negotiating whether or not you feed children.
But the leverage, right?
And the United States has the power. Let's just be clear.
That's it.
Donald Trump could call up Bibi Netanyahu today.
Exactly,
and tonight,
right,
in Israel, this problem would start to be resolved.
I don't disagree.
What I'm saying is that part of the dysfunction, why President Trump cannot instantiate his will, he set this up when he has all these satellite, these different ways of exercising his command. He's got Witkoff over there. He has a Secretary of State. Had he had a unified effort here and a pressure and a resilience and sticking to his points, he would actually effectuate. He's frustrated right now. He sees what you're saying. He'd sit here going,
I don't agree with that.
Just make the phone call. Just tell him, we're not sending you another bullet. Not literally. I'm not sending you another bullet, another missile, another nothing till you feed these people. And I'm getting on the air every day, twice a day. And instead of harassing Jerome Powell or CBS, I'm going to call out you until you feed the children. And it would take about the only time it would take is the time delay between now and the time in Washington and Tel Aviv to start solving the problem.
I agree with you. I'm saying that the issue here is his dysfunction. I think he wants to end this.
He never talks about the death in Gaza. He talks about the Russian soldiers dying more than he talks about the death in Gaza. He does not speak of it.
My comments here are really meant to be more clinical. I know there's deep emotional hatred of President Trump. I'm not taking a side on that.
Chuck
Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries should go put their arm around that man and say, you know what? We've got news for you. You want to, quote unquote, change the subject? You want to look like you care about protecting children? You do this, okay? And you know what? We're going to let you, after you do this, we're going to let you and the Republicans and the maniacs in your party sort out the other children defense issue. We're going to stay out of this in exchange for you feeding the Gazans.
Final point I'll make again is, had he not stovepiped his exercising his command, I think he would actually have to, because he has at moments. But you notice what happened in the last 24 hours. It was Witkoff that made this announcement. I think that was a mistake. He's given Marco Rubio four jobs,
right?
But he ought to be doing one, and it's really important. And we'd be able to achieve this ceasefire and feeding of the children.
As a process matter, I do agree with you that there isn't the right infrastructure there around him, because you don't have a national security staff and separate State Department staff, and you really need that. And he also doesn't have enough people in the State Department. But there's a larger issue, because he's fired so many of them and the quality ones. But there's the more precise issue, I think, as Mark says, is that he has the power of the purse. If he wanted to change this, he could change this.
Well, he has no empathy. Let's just say that. And second, when Trump wants to get things done, he gets it done. A lot of it damaging the public interest. I mean, look at the increase in the ICE budget. Look at the budget proposal he just got through after promising Lisa Murkowski things that she's not going to get.
Look at the Paramount money that he just got.
But I don't think he wants to solve this crisis.
I respectfully disagree. I think he's trying to not only resolve this one, he wants the Nobel Peace Prize.
Just but he's flat not going to get a Nobel Peace Prize using starvation as a weapon.
No, look, he is the president, so he's responsible. So I'm not making any argument to the contrary of that. What I'm saying is that if you woke him up in the middle of the night last night, he'd say, dang, I want this Gaza thing fixed. I want this Ukraine thing to go away. But he's not able to effectuate his intent here. And I think he's done. He's frustrated himself on the way he's arrayed his administration.
I want to bring this in a really frustrating direction. I don't think Trump is going to solve this. I don't think Congress is going to solve this. I think the question is, what do we do as ethical members of society? We can call our legislators. We can show up at the federal building. We cannot buy products from terrorist organizations. But, like, what do we do this weekend?
I'll tell you, the Mike Lawlers and the who's my guy and covers
Josh Riley
Garrison too.
Pat Ryan.
They're going to show up at like the county fair, right?
Right.
I'd ask them one question. Hey, you want to protect children? Yeah. What are you doing about Gaza? Make noise. Do me a favor.
Can pick up the phone right now and make a call.
And I you and I are in league that. Trump's handling of foreign policy, I mean, Steve Witkoff, the ambassador to everything, give me a break, right? Even Henry Kissinger couldn't pull that off successfully. But it's a phone call. I mean, he stopped the conflagration between Iran and at least the open firing part of it between Iran and Israel before I think either side knew he was going to do it. He could start feeding the Gazans in the exact same way.
The one thing I just wanted to read a letter from Suzanne. Congress just passed the big ugly bill that took food away from hungry American children. Do you really think there's a chance in Hades that those who have influence in this nightmare of an administration give two craps about foreign children?
Some members of Congress do, but not the majority.
You know, and people like Rubio used to.
Yeah, and I also believe you can make Trump care. If you sell it to Trump, look. You want a Nobel Peace Prize. I got something that probably looks pretty good, right? Which is stopping starvation.
You know what the big problem is? Israel will not let reporters into Gaza. And the ones that are there, the reporters are struggling with food security. The doctors cannot take care of patients. And I think if you want, you know, Trump watches TV. Israel knows that. They're not letting reporters in. I mean, we're only seeing a limited amount of photos. And, you know, dying of starvation is horrible. It's preceded by organ failure. Not only is food not getting in, but Israel is actually bombing drinking water supplies, desalinization plants. I mean, this is a modern nightmare funded by American taxpayers. Congress isn't going to fix this.
And medicine's not getting in either. That's the other thing.
Well, let's...
But what is the leverage point, though, Mark? I think that's the fundamental question here, and I don't know the answer to it. Where is the point of leverage and I think people speaking up is important, but where, Mark, do you think is the point of leverage that will move Trump to move Netanyahu to let these trucks in, to let the central kitchen in, to let these aid agencies in that have been disassembled because of this cuts in the
Not just the cuts. They physically won't let the food trucks.
Yeah, no,
show
I
up.
Know that. But even the
they're there.
The people who are there to do the work, their resources have been cut because of the broad-based cuts the U.S. has made, the Trump administration has made in these variety of agencies. But go ahead, Mark. Where do you think is the point of leverage?
Oh, again, I just think you have to – if I were Schumer or Jeffries, I would go put my arm around Trump and I'd say, you want to protect children, you want to change the subject, you want a Nobel Peace Prize, make the phone call. And by the way, we'll help you out. The minute you do this, we will foreground this and we will forego – stewing about the other thing. We'll leave that to you, the people who are hunting for Bigfoot and the other conspiracy theorists that you roused up. We can't solve that problem for you, but we as Democrats can get off that train and laud you for this, and we will. The hardliners within the Israeli government have forced Netanyahu into a position of keeping that quote-unquote war alive, so much so that The Economist reported the other day that the newest incursion into the neighborhood of Deir Bashal, I'm sure I'm butchering it, literally they said was because the army had nothing else to do. I mean, that basically they've subdued every other area. This is an area where a lot of those hostages, even the live ones, are believed to be. So they would rather not be routing around in there. But literally, even the chief of the army have said, we got nothing else. In Israel's effectively been reported as saying, we got nothing else to do in here.
To bomb.
Well, it was kind of like, look, go take up, I mean, go look at a picture of the place, for God's sake.
Yeah, how do people even live there?
But also what's going on in the West Bank, you know? I mean, what's going on in the West Bank is troubling as well. But mm-hmm. when you do hear Trump talking about this region, what does he talk about? Clearing it out and making
real estate.
It a resort, right?
I mean, that sounds so cynical, but both Trump and his son have openly talked about this being right on the Mediterranean and it'd be a nice place for development. It's hard not to think.
Talk to Tony Blair and his people about that plan. But the other,
I really think that's what Trump is after.
But the other point you have to make is to the Israelis themselves, mm-hmm. is this isn't in your interest. And I actually think
that's
if you look at Israeli opinion polls,
that's where I'm trying to get
they
at
believe
the
that's,
leverage.
They
that's...
believe that's the case as well.
And I think what I hear everybody saying is now is the time to, well, we're well past it, to focus.
Right.
And I think we can get
there. I think you can be a Zionist and think that children mm-hmm. in Gaza shouldn't starve.
Is there a power base of Israelis?
Go ahead.
Sorry.
We have to take a break. And I would have broken sooner, but you were all scaring me.
Isn't it a scary topic?
It is. It's a horrible topic, and I think
cannot be silent about this.
That's why I wanted to talk as long as we possibly could about it. Let's just take a quick break. We'll be right back. Thank you very much for being with us on this Friday edition of the Roundtable. Quite the barn burner going on here, and we welcome all of you. I love how our listeners can compartmentalize because we're getting these incredible letters in regards to what we were talking about in terms of Gaza and starvation, and they are stomach-churning and very thoughtful and beautiful. I will read a few in a moment. I also want to thank the many, many, many people who have invited us to their carousels.
No. Can we
didn't see that coming.
They want show on carousels.
Well, that's what they want. They want us to bring the show to a carousel.
That's a surprise.
And I think I can't think of anything more fun than that. We got to find a carousel day and
is a round table, and you could argue sometimes we go
around and around and around. That is absolutely right.
This is why I love being on with Mark.
All right, let's go.
Let's
go to some letters. Carl says there is no evidence Trump cares about ending the tragedy of Palestinian starvation. Discussing turning Gaza into a resort with an AI video points in the opposite direction. Mm-hmm. Not a nickel should go to Israel until there is justice for Palestinians, not Hamas. Then Sergio, I support Israel's right to exist, but I cannot see a solution of this conflict by starvation. I fail to see how the Israelis can be so short-sighted into thinking that starving people will buttress their standing in the Middle East. Do they believe that this is winning in the eyes of the world? Are the images of starving Palestinian children no less powerful than the images of starving Jewish children? And please stop calling for Trump to step in. The man does not have an empathetic atom in his body. Then we go to Linda. If American Jews would band together and call out Israel for the genocide they are committing, things would be different. If a large group of American Jews managed to get into Gaza with humanitarian supplies for the Palestinians, I don't think Israel should be shooting
them. Well, many
them.
American Jews are speaking out, and there are well-organized groups like Jewish Voices for Peace, and there are people in Israel speaking out. And there's actually a ship that's left that is supposed to arrive in Gaza in 2 days. I forget the name of it. I heard a really good segment on Democracy Now! This morning. The last time that was attempted with climate change activist Greta Thunberg, they were all captured and turned away. You know, people are trying innovative things, and it's not working.
All right. We have about 20 minutes, and I want to get two big issues in that time, as we have this great group, and I don't want to waste their intellect for 1 second more. Top UN court says countries must act on climate change. The International Court of Justice called global warming an urgent and existential threat at a closely watched case in The Hague. This occurred this week. The International Court of Justice issued a strongly worded opinion saying that states must protect people from the urgent and existential threat of climate change, a major moment for the global environmental movement and for the countries at the greatest risk of harm. It was the first time that the court, which is the United States' highest judicial body, has weighed in on climate change. Judith,
this is both significant and symbolic at the same time, if that makes sense. So the court really took a very, very close look at this. And this case, by the way, was brought by law students in island nations that are being affected by sea level rise and intense heat. The importance of this is this court has only issued 29 advisory opinions in its 80-year history, and only four others were unanimous. And this was a unanimous decision saying that climate change is an urgent and existential threat. These judges were very careful. They had a private briefing with a group of scientists from the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. They don't have enforcement authority with this decision. However, there are a lot of important lawsuits going on around the country against climate polluters. And this decision out of The Hague is going to help those lawsuits. Absent congressional action, the courts are an important arena to try to get climate change effectively addressed. The irony of this coming out this week was not lost on me, because you've got the Trump administration not only defunding important efforts to promote clean, renewable energy, but also heavily subsidizing fossil fuel generation. And, you know, it's easy to point out the problems with the Trump administration, but we also have serious problems here in New York State that I want to point out. Not long ago, President Trump said he was going to cancel an offshore wind project on Long Island, which was fully permitted, ready to go. To her credit, Governor Kathy Hochul stepped in, but the media to save the project. But the media reports, and these are just media reports, and I hope it's not accurate, but the media reports were that the governor told Trump that she would then help facilitate the siting of a fracked gas pipeline in downstate called Williams. So, like, talk about one step forward and two steps back. This is a fracked gas pipeline that was already rejected. The New York Department of Environmental Conservation rejected the water permits. That was upheld in court. And now public comment period has opened on this new approach. And with the pipeline, and we're not going to solve the climate crisis if states like New York are facilitating more burning of fossil fuel. Just today, there is a lawsuit being heard in Kingston, brought by public interest groups like Citizen Action and Push Buffalo, Sierra Club, We Act, suing the Hochul administration for not implementing the state law that is required to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. It's called the Climate Community Leadership Protection Act, that we in the biz call CCLPA. The state of New York is not complying with its own state law that requires a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. So the Hague decision is fascinating. I think it's going to have an impact around the country. I wish it would have an impact in New York. The governor has also said that in the state energy plan, we're not meeting our greenhouse gas reduction goals. And so rather than coming out and saying, okay, we're going to do A, B, and C to meet those goals. The governor is delaying deadlines and also saying that she wants to see nuclear power plants built in upstate New York. So it is a mess, and the earth doesn't care. You walk outside, it's, you know, this is record heat. We had the terrible floods in Texas where so many children were killed. And, you know, Gaza is crucial. Ukraine is crucial. ICE picking up people and kidnapping people is crucial. But we've got to keep our eyes on the climate crisis.
Anybody else want to add to that?
I just want to reinforce one of the things that Judith mentioned, which is that at the same time, the Republican budgets are cutting funding in every direction for whether it's climate change research or programs, the clean energy programs, solar, wind, geothermal, whatever, because they say we have to, you know, reduce our federal budgets. At the same time, they're not only sustaining, but they're increasing funding for fossil fuels. And that has a very costly price, and people need to pay attention to that at these town hall meetings for the next 6 weeks, congressional research recess period. There's going to be a lot of public meetings. This is a good time, whether it's a Democrat, Republican who represents you, to be asking these questions of where is your commitment on climate change and what are we going to do in this interim period? Because obviously, you know, Trump famously had that, what was it, a billion dollar fundraiser.
If he told fossil fuel companies, if you raise $1 billion, I'll do everything you want. And he is doing everything he wants for Exxon and Shell more. And right. BP.
And so I think that things are not going to change. But what is the outlook past the next election? How can we understand what's the basic infrastructure that needs to stay in place so that we can get back on track? And one of the places, the key places that's going to happen is at the state level. And New York State just released its draft state energy plan, open for public comment till October 6th. But in any case, we need to have innovation at the state level.
You know, I just to go ahead. The other side here just for a second and really bring a balance to the conversation, because clearly to be conservative is to conserve resources, whether it be budget resources or the earth. There is only one of the earth. So, I will say that, you know, the reality is, and we don't get to it because of the partisan arguments that are advanced, but we are going to have to cut spending and we're going to need more revenues. You know, we spend about 23.5% of our gross domestic product and at the federal level, and we take in about not quite 17%. So many economists believe that if we move to about 20%, we'll fulfill our pledges we've made in every direction and still be able to balance our budget. That said, to your point, Teresa, you know, if we're making hard choices and we're not yet working together, we need to work together to do all of this. And that means sacrifices and compromises in every direction. But if we're going to do that, then we shouldn't be adding to subsidies for big multinational corporations.
Well, the fossil fuel subsidies, right, though, are
that's what I'm
much
saying.
Bigger.
That's yeah. What I'm saying is that's a contradiction. You know, when you say you're doing something for the purpose of the next generation to conserve budget resources and then you increase that spending, that's not going to work. So
and also on clean energy, one of
the
things that the Biden administration was doing was truly expanding, growing the clean energy manufacturing economy, particularly in solar. And they were reshoring. You know, that was technology that came out of the U.S., ended up going to China. They were successfully reshoring it in a comprehensive way that not only is bringing the manufacturing back, but making sure to work to have, do you have a workforce, a trained workforce who can do the installation work and so on and so forth. And anecdotally, I'll go back to the Coase anecdote where you install floating solar, and it reduces the city's cost by $500,000 a year. So there's these incentives provide exponential economic benefit. So sometimes investments are cost savings.
Well, I mean, so I've always supported an all-the-above energy strategy that's in a common-sense way and is thoughtful and protects our water and our air. So, you know, to that point, I wouldn't have a disagreement. I do think that frankly, all of us are going to have to come together. And this is so important. It's a moral imperative for the next generation. We're going to have to make, and we're not making it now. We have to work together to move back to a balanced budget.
And
What's that sparkly new book in front of you, Judith?
Why, thank you, Joe. So
sorry, Judith.
I'm really.
We're running out of time. I gotta get the plugs in. But go ahead.
I'm really excited to announce that I wrote a book with Adam Mahoney and my colleagues at Beyond Plastics. It's called "The Problem with Plastics: How We Can Save Ourselves and Our Planet Before It's Too Late." It's very relevant to the climate conversation because 99% of plastics is made from fossil fuels. The book will come out December 2nd, published by The New Press.
Yes.
I've now learned that I really need to push pre-sales. So I want to urge all your listeners to contact their local independent bookstore, urge a pre-sale of the book, The Problem with Plastic. It's also already up online. You can order it wherever you order books, and you can go to thenewpress.org to order
Bookshop.org.
Bookshop.org.
And keep it independent, and you can order it online.
Yeah, or go to Oblon Books, or go to
any of your
Market
Block Books. Local...
I really want to push people buying the book through independent bookstores,
yep,
and also buy a book for your library. And pre-order it. You don't want to wait till the last minute. It's the perfect holiday gift coming December 2nd.
And then when, because of the pre-orders, then they'll know how many to order for the store, and it just helps everybody. Speaking of brand new books, Chris Gibson has a brand new book. It's called The Spirit of Philadelphia. It's so new. He's going to be at the Northshire. He's going to be at a Northshire Saratoga event happening on Thursday, this coming Thursday, July 31st at 6 p.m. Now, it's going to be held at the Saratoga Springs Public Library. The bookstore, sadly, is closed because of flooding, which is just horrific. But they're working on it and getting it back up to snuff. But Chris is going to be at the library speaking with Ray O'Connor, much like we did at the Kinderhook bookstore a few weeks ago, which you can hear online, which was a lovely conversation.
Yeah,
and really, really good stuff in the book. And this is a call to recover the founding principles. Good luck.
Yeah, well, Joe, thank you so much. And, you know, I want to be clear that this is not about going back. That's a fiction. Can never go back. But it is about recovering principles about really that address our species. You know, that we're such an amazing species. We have extraordinary ability to love and sacrifice. But if we're being very candid, you know, we can be activated by darker angels, as the founder said, and it can end up in really troubling places. So, you know, this is a book that sits at the intersection of history, philosophy, and public policy. And it's a cautionary tale about what can happen to the spirit, that coalescing energy of a people, of a nation, if it goes dormant. And, you know, I have poured my heart and soul into this for the last 2.5 years. I've got a website. I hope that you'll visit it so that you can learn more about the project. It's called the website is thespiritofphiladelphia.com. thespiritofphiladelphia.com. You visit that website, you can learn more about the genesis, the motivation of the project. You can order the book if you're so interested. You can leave me a message. You can even leave me a message from today if you didn't like something I said here on the roundtable, or maybe you thought something was thoughtful. Either way, but that website is really for me to interact, and I've been enjoying that aspect, Joe. The book's been out for a couple months. I spend a couple hours a day going back and forth with citizens all throughout the country about the ideas in the book. And I just think that I brought up some of them here today, but I mean, we're in a place where we are far away from what the founders saw of concerns about what can happen with power. This is why they decentralized, separated power, kept it checked, transparent, and accountable, because they knew what could happen to us if we consolidate, if we centralize power. So, you know, there's a lot on history and philosophy in here. And so I hope that you'll take the time to read it and to think about it and to reach out to your family and friends. And then I've been joining Zooms. So if you're interested, if you have a book club and you want me to Zoom in about it, I'm happy to do it. I actually enjoy that. So I hope to be interacting with you out there. And Joe, thanks for the opportunity, and thank you so much for that event. We had Sarah Gilbert, the CEO from WAMC. That's there. Right. It was at Mindy's bookstore, Kinrope Books.
Yeah.
So it was a wonderful community event, and this was what Judith was talking about. We're so blessed to have these independent booksellers like this event. I'll be at Thursday. They're an independent bookseller up there as well, with Rachel Person and the whole wonderful bookstore in Saratoga Springs. So there's a great opportunity to support all of these things and really as a psychological community, as a nation. And this is not about homogenizing thought either, because we're proud of the fact that we have spirited debate, like some of which happened here today, and that we have freedom of thought, freedom of expression. But what we need is a dispute resolution mechanism that we agree upon so that we don't shoot each other, that we can actually have peaceful evolutionary change. So that's really what's going on in the spirit of Philadelphia. And I'm doing my best to get the word out about it. So thanks for the opportunity to talk.
Chris Gibson will be with Ray O'Connor, The Spirit of Philadelphia, A Call to Recover the Founding Principles. And we'll be at the Saratoga Springs Library on Thursday night at 6 p.m. in a North Dryer Saratoga event. The Spirit of Philadelphia by a guy wearing a Met shirt.
The underdog.
The Problem with Plastic is the new book from Judith Enk, which is available for pre-order. You guys got anything you want to plug?
I haven't read the book, but so timely, Chris. I'm really eager to read it. I mean, with the anniversary coming up and these issues so at hand. So thank you.
Thank you.
Mark, nothing you want to plug? Push? You're going to be at a car wash, Gaza. Anything? I don't
hope
know.
Hope everyone has an enjoyable weekend.
Yeah, yeah right. Yeah. There,
go find your member of Congress at the county fair.
There we go. That is our order. Yeah, and if you get bored, just with the one item we didn't get to was if you get bored this weekend, just go and watch the awkward video between Jerome Powell and Donald Trump.
It's an episode of Veep.
Yeah, it is. God, it's just and yet so entertaining. My thanks to all. We are blessed to have these wonderful, wonderful panelists with us, and I thank them so much for taking the time out. Teresa Bourgeois, Judith Enk. Chris Gibson, will you come back?
Yes,
please
I will.
Come back. You please, please. Come back.
I'm excited to come back.
Mark Whitman, thank you all. Have a beautiful weekend. We will have another hour, a full hour of the roundtable coming up after this short break.